All right, we're beginning here on the top of Chaf Aleph Amud Aleph by the two dots. Here the Gemara is quoting from the Mishnah, Yesh Zchut Tola Gimel Shanim, that we have Zchuyot with regards to the woman which postpone the effectiveness of the Mesota. The Mishnah says there's postponement for a year, 2 years, 3 years. And the Gemara wants to know, what exactly is this Zchut? What is this merit that gives the woman the protection from the Mesota? The Gemara says, Zchut Demai. What is this zchut that we're speaking about? Ilema zchut de Torah. If we're talking about the zchut of limud Torah, ha ina mitzuva vosahi. She's not commanded in the mitzvah of limud Torah, and therefore that can't be what we are speaking about over here. When it comes to limud Torah, the Gemara in Kiddushin tells us v'ilmanetem otam et b'neichem velo b'noteichem, that there is a chiyuv to teach Torah, and therefore a chiyuv of Talmud Torah with regards to your sons, and now with regards to your daughters, which means that a child that is a male is mechuyav in limud Torah because he's a mitzuveh ve'useh. He's commanded to learn Torah, and since he must learn Torah, he is mikayim the mitzvah of Talmud Torah when he does so. The woman, on the other hand, is an eina mitzuvah ve'useh, which means that she's not commanded to learn. But if she does learn, she will get schar. Right here, the Gemara seems to indicate that that would not be sufficient schar to provide her the protection that she needs. Had it been that she did it voluntarily, and then she was in a mitzvah vosa, you would have thought that maybe that should suffice as this chut. The Gemara rejects that. It's not clear here why the Gemara rejects that. If the Gemara is rejecting it because the women are just not mitzvah vosa, and that is the deficit here, or is it that women don't learn because they are not mitzvah? And since they're not mitzvah, that's not going to be the pitaron, because most women are not learning. Ella, zchut mitzvah. Must be a zchut of some mitzvah. Zchut mitzvah, mimigana kulehai. Wait a minute. When it comes to the merit of mitzvot, they don't provide that type of protection. Vatanyo, don't we have a beraita? Et zudorash, Rabbi Menachem Bar Yossi. Kiner mitzvah, b'torah or. Mitzvah is compared to a candle, and Torah is compared to light. Tala hakatuv et mitzvah mener v'et Torah be'or. So we connect, or the mashal and the nimshal are that candle equals mitzvah, or equals Torah. Et mitzvah mener lomar lecha maner ena megina l'fi sha'a. Reason that a mitzvah is compared to a ner is because just like a candle has a limited life or a duration that will expire. So too, a mitzvah in a megina l'fi sha'a. So too, a mitzvah only has protective qualities in a temporary way. Beta Torah ba'or, lo mechama or megin le'olam. Just like or is protective forever, or the alternate girsa, which is in the Yaakov, is me'ir le'olam, is always there. There's always light that's there. Af Torah megina le'olam. So too, Torah is protective in nature forever. Vomer, and it says in the pasuk, "Bihit alechecha tancheh utach ze olam hazeh." So this is the pasuk that we quote anytime a person makes a siyum. They quote this pasuk, "Bihit alechecha tancheh utach," that when you walk, it will accompany you. That is olam hazeh. Bishochvecha tishmor alecha, when you go to sleep, it will protect you. This sleep, meaning the permanent sleep, zomita, it will protect you in death. Vehakitzota hi tisichecha. And when you awaken, it will be your conversation. That is latid lavo. Vakitzota, meaning the ultimate waking up, tchiyata mitim. Over there, itisechecha. So that is the power of Torah. Mashal, ladam shaya malech bi'ishon alayla. Vafila. Mashal that we can bring here is like an individual is going in the depths of the night. Darkness. Umit yare. And now he's fearful because of a number of obstacles that are going to be there. So he's afraid of the thorns, the ditches, and the pits along the way, and the thistles. And from wild animals, and from marauders. And he doesn't know which way to go. He gets all of a sudden a torch of fire. At that point, he is now saved or taken care of as far as the obstacles like the kotzim and the ditches and the barkanim, that still doesn't protect him from the wild animals and the marauders. He still doesn't know which way to go. Once the dawn breaks, then already he is safe now from these wild animals and from the marauders. Still doesn't know which way to go. Then once he reaches the fork in the road, now he knows which way he's supposed to be going. He has direction. The Gemara is going to explain the mashal, each piece of the mashal. I'll just note here that you have different types of problems that are arising in the darkness here. You have problems that are, we call them obstacles that the individual himself is bumping into. And those are the kotzim, pchatim, and barkanim. Those are issues or items that get in the way of people, but that's something that you go towards and you bump into these obstacles. On the other hand, you have obstacles or problems that are the chayera'a and the listim, which are outside problems that come and they attack you from the outside. And then you have more, I would say, more existential questions, which is the derech. Which way am I supposed to be going? What's the route that I'm supposed to be taking? So each one of these obstacles represents a different type of problem or issue. You have what we call the yetzer hara, which works against the person. That's something that's internal. That's a person's desires. That's a person's flaws that catch up with them and cause them to sin. Those are the kotzim, the barkanim, and the pchatim. Then we also have outside influences, outside stimuli, which is the environment that a person finds themselves in. You have a bad friend, a bad environment that one is in, a bad situation. Those also influence the person or cause them to sin. That's equivalent to the chaya ra'ah and the listim. And then there's the bigger question of the direction or the purpose one has in life. And that is represented by the malech baderech, meaning which fork in the road, which way to go. In addition, it probably derives, the question it also probably derives from the pasuk that we quoted before, which is kiner mitzvah, v'torah or, v'derech chayim tochot musar. So there are also three stages. There's ner mitzvah, torah or, and derech chayim. So those are the three things that are being mentioned over here. You have the mitzvot, the torah, and then the derech chayim, the way of life. And that's what the Gemara is going to break down here, the three different stages, the three different items that took place in this mashal, which will be explained here. Davar acher, avira mechaba mitzvah, and avira can wipe out a mitzvah, vein avira mechaba Torah. But an avira cannot wipe out the zchut of limud Torah. Now, doesn't mean, when you say an avira is mechaba mitzvah, doesn't mean extinguish mitzvah in the sense that the mitzvah doesn't exist anymore. It just means that the mitzvah's power is not there to protect oneself from the punishment of the avira. It's not strong enough to prevent one from then facing the issues that are associated with that avera. On the other hand, the Torah can provide that type of protection or can provide that type of shield against some of the onashim that come from an avera. The Gemara is clearly differentiating between mitzvah and Torah and saying that the schar of a mitzvah is limited in some way, does not have the capabilities that the schar of Torah does. Schar of Torah far exceeds that in some way, and therefore the Gemara feels that it can't be that zchut mitzvah is what's helping out this woman, because zchut mitzvah never reaches that level of a zchut Torah, and so because of that, you can't, based on that, you can't suggest that the zchut that she has here is zchut mitzvah, not zchut Torah. So the Gemara here is going to get sidetracked with all of this, but that is the big perspective on what the Gemara is saying here. Every mitzvah has different rewards, but clear here is the Gemara sees the Chut Torah exceeding all of those. So now, it's interesting that Pachad Yitzchak, Rav Hutner, in his Sefer on Shavuot, Mamar Lamed Dalet, he brings from a Marsha in Baba Kama. The Marsha in Baba Kama was attending a Siyum, Masechet. And at the end of the Siyum Masechet, they were benching. After the Siyum, they had a Sudat Mitzvah, they're benching. And they went to say, Shasimcha b'ma'ono. At the end of a Siyum Masechet, which is not our practice, obviously, but they were borrowing that from a wedding. mean that by weddings, by Sheva Brachot, we say that the Shasim Brachim B'Mauno is added into the Birkat HaMazon. So they wanted to do the same thing here, but the Siyum Masechet, they felt that it was a very special Simcha. It was something that is celebrated, is on par with marriage and the excitement of marriage in Sheva Brachot, which we spoke about when we had our Siyum. But the fact is that they wanted to add in Simcha B'Mauno. Marsha objected strenuously to that and said that it was incorrect. So Rav Hutner over there wants to explain why based on our Gemara over here. He says that the difference between Limud HaTorah and Asiyah Masechet is very different than the Simcha B'Mauno that is said by a wedding. And he bases it on the Kiner Mitzvah B'Torah Or. He says that the Gemara in Chagiga talks about that there are different Rikiyot, there are different heavens above, and one of those heavens is called Ma'on. And in the heaven of Ma'on, there are malachim there that sing Shira, but they only sing Shira at night. During the day, they don't sing Shira because they defer or give deference to Klal Yisrael who's singing Shira, who says Kedusha, who davens to Hashem during the day. They're out of deference to Klal Yisrael. Those malachim don't sing Shira. So only sing Shira at night, not during the day. And so he says that, Shasimcha b'me'ono, that terminology is only relevant or appropriate when you're dealing with a mitzvah, when you're dealing with something that is not around the clock, something that's not permanent. Just like by the ma'on, the malachim there only sing shira at night and not during the day. So that's appropriate when you're dealing with a mitzvah, even the mitzvah of marriage, which is something that is so essential and so paramount. But yet, it's a mitzvah, and a mitzvah has that quality that it only has temporary or partial protection, not around the clock or full protection. On the other hand, Torah, which is something that is around the clock, v'gita bo yomam v'layla, and it provides that protection, permanent protection and full-time protection, therefore it would be inappropriate to use shasimcha b'mono. It's actually something that would, in a sense, degrade the level of Torah to that of a level of a mitzvah. And so it would be wrong to say simcha b'mono by Torah, not because the simcha b'mono by the wedding is so great that you can't say it by the Torah, but the other way around. The limud Torah and the Torah itself is so great that a simcha b'mono is inappropriate to say by the case of a siyum masechet. That's how the Pachad Yitzchak explains, based on our Gemara here, the reason why you can't use simcha b'mono with regards to a siyum masechet. So now the Gemara says, Shneamar, how do you know that an avera can wipe out a mitzvah, but Torah cannot be wiped out by an avera? Shneamar, mayim rabim lo yuchlu lechabot et ahava. Tremendous waters cannot extinguish the love. So the love here is referring to the love of Torah, and that love cannot be extinguished with tremendous amount of waters by averot. So now again, Torah mitzvah has a limited amount of protective quality, which is that when you're osik in the mitzvah, it has that protective quality. When you're not osik in the mitzvah, it does not have that protective quality. And that's why the Gemara is concluding here that it can't be that it's a mitzvah that's protecting her, because the mitzvah wouldn't suffice. And therefore, it's not going to protect her from the meisotah. The only thing that could provide her that protection is Torah, because Torah has that protective quality that exceeds the Torah itself or the learning itself. And that's why they are searching for this protective quality that is going to save her. I'm Rav Yosef. Now, Rav Yosef is coming to explain how we deal with mitzvah versus Torah, and that the difference between them, what does that mean in this context? Mitzvah bi'idna da'asik ba megano umatzlo. A mitzvah, when you're engaged in the mitzvah, it's protective in nature, umatzlo, and it has forward protection, which is migana means it protects against onesh or other things that were supposed to happen to the individual. Umatzlo is a forward-looking saving, which is it protects one from the yitzahara or from doing an avera. Bidna de lo asigba, in time that you're not engaged with it, aguni megano, it still affords the protection from punishment and from other items, but atzule lo matzlo. But it doesn't afford you the protection from the yitzahara or from the problems that can cause you to sin in the future. Torah, but when it comes to Torah, ben bi'idna da'asikba, ben bi'idna da'lo asikba, doesn't matter whether you're engaged in Torah or not engaged in Torah, megana umatzlo. It has both of those protective qualities, which is megana, it shields one from punishment, it shields one from bad things happening, but also matzlo, it has the protective nature of forward-looking protection, which it saves one from getting engaged in Averot or falling to the Yetzara. Matufla Rabo, or the other Gisa Rovo, Elamiato, if that's true, Doeg Vachitofel Milo Aske Bitorah, Vamailo Igina Layu, Doeg Adomi Vachitofel, based on the Gemara in Sanhedrin, says that they were both tremendous Talmidei Chachamim, to the point where they far exceeded David HaMelech. And we saw that before that David HaMelech was jealous of them because they were so much more erudite than he was. So if they had that protection of Torah, how were they not protected from falling prey to doing the wrong things? Achitofel, who joins the merit of Shalom against David HaMelech, Doeg Adomi, who at least what we find with regards to Shaul, he helps out with killing out the Ir Nova Kohanim. He tries to turn David in or get David into trouble. Again, there we never see, as we mentioned at the time when we learned in the Gemara, we never see what happens to Doeg in the end. But the Gemara seems conclusive that Doeg's end is not a good thing. Midah keneged midah, that he also gets taken out. Elama Rova, if that's the case, and Torah was so protective, then they should have been saved. The fact they weren't saved shows that that can't be the case. Elama Rova. So Rabbi now amends Rabbi Yosef's statement to accommodate this issue, which is Torah, Bidna Dasik Ba, Torah, when you're engaged in it, Megana Umatzlo, then it is protective, again, both in the sense it shields you from Isurim and Onesh, Umatzlo, and it protects you on a forward basis, it protects you from sinning and from the Yetzahara, Bidna Dasik Ba, at a time that you're not engaged in it, Aguni Megano, then it has the protective qualities of protecting against punishment, azule lo matzlo. But it doesn't give you that forward protection of falling prey to sin or yetzahara. And that would then explain about Doeg and Achitofel, because then it would explain that even though they had learned Torah, when they weren't engaged in Torah, then they fell prey to their yetzahara. They fell prey to these problems. Mitzvah, ben be'idna da asikba, ben be'idna da lo asikba, it comes to a mitzvah, whether you're engaged in it or you're not engaged in it, agune migano, it has that protective quality against onashim, atzulei lo matzla. It never provides the protection against the yetzara or against the future pitfalls that one might fall in. The way that Rava now explains it, that solves the problem of doeg achitovo, but also provides us with a difference between a Torah and mitzvah. So Rava and Rav Yosef, or Rava and Rav Yosef over here, give explanations of the Braita that allow us to say that there is a zchut mitzvah that would protect the woman. Because they have zchut mitzvah in their understanding of this Braita that is differentiating between Torah and mitzvot. It's not that Torah has this and mitzvah doesn't have it. It's that Torah has more or has some additional aspect to it that the mitzvah does not have. And therefore the mitzvah does have the required or requisite protection that the sota would need. And the answer to the question is that she will have mitzvot, and those are the zchuyot that we're talking about that would protect her. Tosfot here points out that it becomes very difficult then in the end, which is v'teima, my high diktani bebraita. So why is it in the end that the braita says that mitzvah is a ner, and Torah is an or? Why? Because a mitzvah is temporary in nature, so therefore it's compared to the ner, which extinguishes over time. Whereas Torah is compared to or, which is a permanent feature, and therefore, it goes on forever. According to Rova's explanation here in the end, that's not the case. By mitzvah, whether you are engaged in the mitzvah or not engaged in the mitzvah, migano, it does provide protection from yisurim. On the other hand, when it comes to Torah, whether you're engaged in it or not engaged in it, again, it provides migano. When you are engaged in it, it also provides matzlo. But then, there's nothing that's permanent with regards to Torah that is not true by the mitzvah. And therefore, he says that Rava doesn't in the end seem to fit so well into the Lashon of the Braita. Because the Braita talks about a mitzvah being temporary and Torah being permanent. And over here, neither is true. Because the mitzvah has permanent migano, and so does Torah. Torah has matzlah, but that's only in the case when you're engaged in it. Mitzvah never has matzlah. So then where is it that Torah is permanent and always has a feature that's not apparent by a mitzvah that does not come out in the Lashon of Rova? So Tosfot leaves that as somewhat problematic of Rova's explanation now because it doesn't really fit back in to the Braita that we saw above. All right, so now the Gemara continues and says, Olam zchut de Torah. All right, so it must be that we're looking for Zchut de Torah to protect her, because Zchut de Mitzvah is not sufficient to protect her in this situation. But what is it? Because she's Eino Mitzuvah Ba'osa. So how does she garner that Zchut de Torah? Udgamart Eino Mitzuvah Ba'osa. You already said that she's not commanded in Limud Torah. How does she then acquire this Mitzvah of Torah? Nehi de Pekudei Lo Mifkido. Okay, she's not commanded in Mitzvah of Torah. Ba'agro demakrin umatnin banayhu. From the reward that they, here, whether it's that they themselves teach their children Torah, or, more importantly, they take their children to the cheder in order to learn Torah. Ve'natrin lehu gavrayu ad atumi be midrasho. And they wait for their husbands to return from the Beit Midrash. Over here, they're not talking about coming back daily. They're talking about, like, the story of Rabbi Akiva, where they send their husbands off to the Beit Midrash in other cities, and they await the return of their husbands. And that's char, milo palgan ba'adayu. Don't they get at least half credit for that? So this is, right, it's actually a theory that is promoted in the secular court systems today with regards to divorce settlements, that even though all the money was earned by the husband in the marriage, nevertheless, the wife is entitled to half of those earnings because she facilitated the husband be able to do those earnings because she stayed home, took care of the house, took care of the kids and the family, and therefore she's equally deserving of a portion of those earnings or half of those earnings. And this is here what the Gemara says, that since she's the facilitator of her husband's learning and of her children's learning, she gets credit. She gets full credit there as if she is splitting with them the schar of Limud Torah. And that belongs to her, that Limud Torah or that schar of Limud Torah belongs to her. And that's the schut that can protect the woman in this instance, is the schut Torah that comes from this merit. So this is a merit where the merit can be full-fledged mitzuveh ba'oseh, because she's taking credit not from her own Limud Torah, but from her husband or children's Limud Torah, which are individuals who are mitzuveh ba'oseh. And since their Limud Torah is mitzuveh ba'oseh, and she gets half credit for that, then she now has credit with regards to a zchut Torah that is on par with their husband's limud Torah. That's how she is saved in this case. Again, it's interesting, the Pachad Yitzchak in Mamar Yud Gimel in Shavuot also speaks about this in the context of Birkat Torah. That is that the Tosafot in the Gemara and Brachot and the Chaf Aleph ask, why is it that when it comes to Birkat Torah, we make Birkat Torah once in the morning, and then you don't make it again during the day? Even though you're not learning all day, you might start your day out learning, right? That's why you do Daf Yomi right after you daven, so that one starts out their day with learning. But right after that, you might do something else, and then maybe come back to learn later, or learn different times during the day, yet you don't have to make a Birkat Torah again. Whereas, by the mitzvah of Sukkah, or the mitzvah of Tefillin, every time you take off your Tefillin and put on your Tefillin, you'd have to make a new Bracha when you put on the Tefillin. You go ahead into the sukkah, you eat in the sukkah, you make a leishei basukkah, you leave the sukkah, you come back later, you'd have to make another leishei basukkah. How come by those mitzvot, we say you have to make a bracha each time you engage in it, yet by Birkat Torah, you don't have to make a bracha every time you engage in it? So Tosafot over there says that the mitzvah of Torah is different than the other mitzvot. The mitzvah of Torah is v'gita bo yomam v'layla. That one has to be engaged in Torah on a full-time basis. There is no such thing as a time when one is not chayav in limud Torah. Whereas by mitzvot, you have dispensations which allow you out not to do a mitzvah. You don't have to be engaged in the mitzvah all the time. You have to engage in the mitzvah when it's relevant to be engaged in the mitzvah. Whether that's tefillin, whether that's sukkah. So there are those that question the Tosafot over there, especially from tefillin, where tefillin also is a mitzvah to wear all day. We happen not to wear them all day because we don't necessarily have the ability or the mindset in order to wear them all day. But that doesn't mean that one shouldn't be wearing tefillin all day. So how come tefillin don't fall into that same category as limud Torah? So there's a famous formulation of Rav Soloveitchik, which we spoke about at the time that we learned this Tosafot over there, that the mitzvah of limud Torah is not limited to limud Torah, but limud Torah is a perspective on life. It is, as Rabbi David quotes, a latent awareness that one has to have all the time. Anytime they're engaged in any activity, it's governed by the rules of the Torah and the perspective of the Torah. It's a blueprint for one's life. It's a lifestyle. It's not simply a mitzvah or an intellectual pursuit. Torah permeates the being of every individual who's engaged. And therefore, it's different than mitzvot. Along those lines, the Pachad Yitzchak Rav Hutna over here says something similar, also to distinguish between mitzvot and Torah. He says that Torah has a unique quality to it, and that's based on the fact that Torah has an ability to be mikuyam ayidei bitula. It's a famous statement of Reish Lakish with regards to bitula hi kiyuma, that sometimes bitula Torah is the kiyuma Torah. And that's why one stops learning Torah in order to do hotzata meit, haknasat kala. It makes no sense why one should have to stop learning Torah in order to gauge in mitzvot. Because if Torah is the biggest, best mitzvah you can do, ha'osek mitzvah poter min mitzvah, and therefore if you're engaged in limud Torah, why should you have to stop to do anything? Why do you have to stop to do mitzvot that nobody else can do on your behalf? Why do you have to stop to do mitzvot like haknasat kala and hotzata meit? Ella, that embedded in the mitzvah of Torah is that limud Torah is amanat lasot. That one has to learn Torah in order to do what is said in the Torah. Executing on that which is written in the Torah and engaging in the mitzvot is part of the condition of learning Torah so that one can do these things and one must engage in these things. And when one engages in a mitzvah, it's not that they're mivatel Torah. It's actually a part of their kiyuma Torah. It's actually upholding the Torah. So that bitula hi kiyuma, that sometimes desisting from learning Torah is actually a kiyuma Torah when you're engaging in mitzvot, you're engaging in activities that actually uphold the Torah and support the Torah. And therefore, Torah has this unique quality, which is that you can engage in something else and actually be mevatel from the Torah and still acquire full credit as if you are learning Torah or osig b'Torah. And that's why Birkat HaTorah extend all day, because bitula hi kiyuma. Even when you're not engaged in Torah, that might be a kiyum haTorah in and of itself. Because that which activities that you're engaging in are what allow the individual to be mekayim the Torah, that which they learned. And similarly over here, he says that the similar effect over here with regards to the woman. The fact that the woman facilitates the ability for the man and the child to learn Torah, that is a part of her reward. Because that's a unique aspect of Torah. We don't find that by any other mitzvah. We don't find it that if you facilitate someone doing a mitzvah, you get credit, full credit, as if you did the mitzvah. You might get credit for helping someone out, or for engaging the person in the mitzvah. Yeah, you get credit. But we don't want to say to you, you did the mitzvah. It's as if you did it. It's as if you get full credit. That's only by Torah that that's the case. And that's because of this unique quality of Torah, that part of Torah allows that an individual who is a facilitator for the kiyuma Torah, as if they've learned Torah, it's as if they have this chut of Torah. And we see that by bitulahi kiyuma. We also see it over here. It's another example of this, where the woman facilitating the limud Torah is not just considered to be aiding and abetting, but rather she's is deemed to be as if she engaged in Torah, as if she learned Torah. Again, we find that with regards to din. It says over there that Moshe was engaged in the activities of adjudicating the people. And the Gemara says there that kol osek, anybody who's involved in adjudicating cases in a din, ki'ilu, Hashem makes as if you learned Torah kol hayom kulo. Again, the same idea. Here the person is using din Torah in order to adjudicate the cases. He's serving the people. He's doing the mitzvah Torah. Therefore, he's deemed as if he's limud Torah kol hayom. He wasn't learning Torah all day. But the fact that he's engaged in activities that are prescribed by the Torah, that is the equivalent of limud Torah. And that's why Birkat HaTorah is different then Birkat HaMitzvot, and that's also why the woman here can collect schar like no other place, right? Like no other mitzvah. She can get full credit for limud Torah here in being a facilitator, unlike any other mitzvah where being a facilitator makes you someone who aids or abets, but not somebody who doesn't make you as if you did the mitzvah. And that's a key distinction between Tashmishei Kedusha and Tashmishei Mitzvah. Tashmishei Mitzvah can be thrown out after you're finished with them. Tashmishei Kedusha, things that are Tashmishim of things that are permanent, like Torah, they are permanent Kedusha, and they don't lose their Torah. And therefore, Chaim Volozhin in Nefesh HaChaim writes there that that's the reason why the halacha is that a Talmid Chacham who becomes older, and whether his mind isn't as sharp anymore, or physically he can't learn anymore, he can't teach anymore, that he still has a din of a Talmid Chacham, and you have to treat him like a Talmid Chacham, because he's considered to be a Tashmish Kedusha. Torah has that unique quality of affecting the Tashmishei Kedusha and giving permanent Kedusha to items versus a mitzvah, which is only temporary. So based on that explanation, both of the Tosafot and Brachot, as well as the explanation of why the woman here has a unique connection to Torah. That's how the Pachad Yitzchok Rav Hutner explains the difference between Birkat HaTorah and Birkat HaMitzvah, a distinction between Torah and Mitzvot. My Parshat Drachim. What was the Parshat Drachim that was in the Mashal over there at the fork in the road? Amar Rav Chista, Zit Talmud Chochom V'yom Amita. This is a Talmud Chochom who reaches the day of death. Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchok Amar Zit Talmud Chochom Yirat Chet. This is a Talmud Chochom who has Yirat Chet. Mar Zutra Amar Zit Talmud Chochom D'Salkele Shmaitata Alibah De'Hilchata. So this is a Talmud Chochom whose halachot get accepted and they become the normative law. What the Gemara is saying over here is that we had the Mashal before with the obstacles along the way. And the Gemara said along the way a person gets benefits of the avuka, the torch. Then he gets the benefit of Amud HaShachar, the light. And then he gets to the Parshat Drachim, he gets to the fork in the road. So Gemara wants to know what those milestones are that provide the individual that protection. It's obvious to the Gemara that the avuka is a mitzvah, because ne'er mitzvah. So when you get the avukah that perfects you or deals with the issues like the pachatim, ditches, and the barkanim, and the kotzim that were along the way, the avukah, the mitzvah, protects you from those damaging items. Things that you would trip over, obstacles that you run into, the mitzvah protects you from those items. Then we said that the amud HaShachar was limud HaTorah. So limud HaTorah not only protects you from those obstacles that the person comes upon. And again, before we said that was like a mashal for the Yetzer Hara and from the internal desires of the individuals, the flaws of the individual. But there's the Chaya Ra'an Listim you get protected from when there is Amud HaShachar, Limud HaTorah. Limud HaTorah also protects you from outside stimuli, outside influences that are able to create a certain amount of protective wall around the individual so that they're not only protected from things that come from them, but also things that come from the outside. But then the Gemara said, Parshat Drachim. Once you reach the Parshat Drachim, then you're on your way. Everything's fine. What is that Parshat Drachim that one reaches? So here the Gemara makes a number of suggestions as to what that Parshat Drachim is. When can a person know that they're on the Derech and they're not going to be turned off that Derech anymore? Well, how do they know that they've reached their final goal or they're no longer going to be turned away from Torah, Mitzvot, and those protections? When is that point? Where is that Parshat Drachim? Where is that fork in the road? So the first opinion, and again we said that it connects to the end of the Pasuk, which is that Derech Chaim Tochot Musar, that the way of life is Tochot Musar. What is that? So here we have a number of possibilities. The Rav Chista suggests that it's Yom HaMita. When a person dies, and they die as a Talmud Chacham, then they know they've gotten there. Because once you passed away, obviously there's no more chance that you go off the Derech anymore. But it might also not be just Yom HaMita, the day of death, but thinking about Yom HaMita, remember, Tochot Musar, the one who keeps him quiet, Musar, the greatest Musar that one can have is Yom HaMita, which is the day of death. That's what the Mishnah Navot says, that, Shuv, Yom Echad Lifnei Mitatecha. You should do Tshuva the day before you die. Gemara says, or Avot and Rabbi Natan, and the Gemara Brachot says, how do you know which day you're gonna die? Oh, he doesn't know which day he's gonna die. Kol Yomav B'Tshuva. Therefore, every day, you might be the day before you die, so you're always doing Tshuva. But a person keeps in mind Yom HaMita, that has a significant impact on them. That's a person who's very focused and directed. And Yom HaMita keeps them on the path because they know that if they're going to die, they're going to pay a price for this. And that keeps them on the path. Nachman Yitzchok Marzit Talmud Chacham, V'Yirat Chet. Yirat Chet is something that keeps the person on the path. So that's the way that Rashi explains it over here. Shetorah Melam Dato, Divrei Mitzvah V'Divrei Isur. The Torah gives you instructions about how to deal with this, to what to do, what not to do, so on and so forth. V'yirat chet mon'o milur dof achrei yitzro. And the yirat chet protects him from running after the yetzer hara. So a combination of limud HaTorah and yirat chet bring to the wholeness or the wholesomeness of the individual that's the parshat Drachim. He no longer will be turned away. Because he has limud HaTorah and yirat chet, that brings to a person to a path that is straight and narrow, and he won't go after that path anymore. Limud HaTorah by itself won't do it, neither will Yirat Chet. You need both of them together, the combination of the two, to reach that point. The last suggestion was, Zet Talmud Chacham D'Sakalei Shmaita Libet D'Hilchata, which again, the Gemara says in many places. We saw that with Moshe Rabbeinu when he was davening for Yehuda, that when his bones were bouncing around and went through different stages, when he came up to Shemayim, he davened for him that he should understand what was going on in the Beit Midrash. And then he still wasn't having his halachot be accepted. So Moshe David also, that his halachot should be accepted. You see that, like that's the ultimate goal or the pinnacle of heights that one can reach is that not only do they have Torah, but their Torah is widely accepted and becomes normative. And that is something that is unique. So if a person reaches that point in time, then they'll definitely be safe from the Yetzirah and the Chet, because they now not only have the protection of Torah and Mitzvah, but they have the fact that they have now been widely accepted. That they have now become the common practice, or they have become the default way that people look at certain things, and that already brings them to a different level where they'll be afforded a protection that they won't fall prey to the Yetzirah anymore. Whether that's because the fact is that they're reached a level, if they're accepted, that must mean that they're on a level where the Yetzirah doesn't have power over them. Or maybe because the person whose Torah has been accepted already realizes what they are and has to hold himself at a certain level. That's what Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says in the Sichlet Musar, the secret to not falling prey to Aveirot many times is to be Nisgav. To hold oneself at a certain height and realize that it's beneath me. It's beneath my dignity to do this. Because I'm someone who is a Talmud Chacham. I'm a person who is engaged in Torah. I'm an important person. So I can't fall prey to that. So maybe that's the meaning here also. That once your Torah has been accepted widely, this person is a Odom Choshuv. This is an individual who's a Gadol Ador. Then they also have to act that way. And in acting that way, it prevents them from falling prey to the Yetzer Hara anymore. And so those are the suggestions as to what the Parshat HaDrachim means over here. And then, Davar Acher, this is what? Avira Mechaba Mitzvah, Meni Avira Mechaba Mitzvah. So now again, the Gemara goes back to that, then a mitzvah can be wiped out by an Avira, but Torah cannot be wiped out by an Avira. So now, Amar Rav Yosef. Darshe Rabbi Menachem by Rabbi Yosef, the high crock is Sinai. So Rabbi Yosef says, Rabbi Menachem Rabbi Yosef, Darshan, this pasuk like Sinai, meaning, as if he got it at Har Sinai. It's a very interesting accolade because Rav Yosef himself is called Sinai. Again, the Gemara in Brachot, Rav Yosef is called Sinai and Rav is called Oker Harim. So the Gemara there, they ask about which should be the Rosh Yeshiva, but here Rav Yosef is giving that compliment to someone else. Rav Yosef, who is considered to be Sinai, says about Rav Menachem Bar Yosef that he dies in the Pasuk like Sinai. Vilmalei darshua doeg v'achitofel, hachi lo radfu batar David. If Doeg and Achitofel had darshan in the Pasuk in this manner, they wouldn't have been chasing after David. Now, as far as the girsa here of Achitofel and Doeg, you can see in the Tosfot Shans over here, Nira Delo Garsin and Doeg. Doesn't make sense to include Doeg. Sharei Amaseh Batsheva Kayamin. The Gemara here is talking about the incident with Batsheva and David. Achab Doeg Ma Kvar Avdu Yamim Rabim. He was long gone from then. And he never saw that period of time, and Doeg and Achitofel never overlapped. So based on that, the Tosfot Shans of here suggests that the girsa here should not be Doeg and Achitofel, but just simply Achitofel. It's also interesting to know, just in general, that people don't think about it, but Achitofel was the grandfather of Batsheva. So that makes it an interesting dynamic over here in terms of Achitofel's relationship to David as being the grandfather of Batsheva. If David sinned with Batsheva, what Achitofel's perspective on this was. But here, anyway, they said, had they dashed in the Pasuk like Rabbi Nachem ben Barabbi Yossi, then they wouldn't have run themselves into trouble. Dichtiv. Leimor le'lukim azavo. They said that God must have left him. My darush. What was this, the drasha? Either it's Doeg or Achitofel or just Achitofel. What were they, doresh? V'lo yireh b'chai v'atabar. The pasuk that is found in Dvarim with regards to your military encampment. Over there it says that one should make sure that they have their restrooms, their privies on the outside of the machaneh, and also that if someone is tameh, that they should leave the machaneh, because in the idyllic form, when an army goes out to battle, they're not just going out to battle, Hashem is with them, the Shekhinah is present in the machaneh. And they used to bring the Aron with them, that God was present when they were going to battle. And therefore, lo yirecha ervat davar, because if there is ervat davar, the continuation of the pasuk is, then Hashem Elokecha can't be with you. God won't be able to be with you. He won't be able to stay in your machaneh. So they darshan lo yirecha ervat davar in a more literal sense. So that ervat davar, he was engaged in arayot. When you're engaged in arayot, God leaves. God will no longer be present with you. So they believed, leimor elukim azavo, that God left David HaMelech. And therefore, it was okay to rebel. It was okay to reject David. Because David HaMelech no longer had God on his side. He was no longer the Mashiach Hashem. He was no longer the chosen one of God, the anointed one of God. And therefore, Achitofel felt justified in joining the Merit of Shalom for that reason, because he felt that David HaMelech no longer was the Mashiach Hashem, because he had sinned with Batsheva lo yerecha be'er bat davar. From here, you know that the Gemara clearly in this instance is unlike what the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, the Gemara in Shabbat, the kol omer David chata ino lo toeh. Anybody who says David did a chait is mistaken, and that's based on this premise that anybody who went out to Milchama Beit David used to give a get before they left, and the Gemara deals with it. Here, the Gemara seems on a simple level just to say that David sinned by Batsheva, and that's what caused Achitophel to believe that David was not deserving of Hashem's providence anymore, or Hashem was no longer with him. They didn't recognize Shavira Mechaba Mitzvah, that an Aveira wipes out a Mitzvah, Vein Aveira Mechaba Torah. Whereas an Aveira cannot wipe out Torah. And that was the quote that we saw before, which is, Maim Rabim Lo Yuchlu Lechabot Et Ahava, that great waters can't wash away that love. I mean, David, who had engaged in Torah, was still covered or protected by Torah, despite the fact that he had engaged in Arayot. This has to be reconciled with what we saw back on Daf, Dalet Amud Bet. If you remember there, on the end of Dalet Amud Bet, a couple lines, six lines from the bottom over there, we have a memra from Rav, which is, Kol Abal Eishidish, anyone who gets involved with Eishidish, even if he's like Avram Avinu, even if he's like Moshe Rabbeinu and engaged in Torah, and in itzol migdinah shel geinom, he's not protected from the din of geinom. So over there, the Gemara seems to indicate that engaging in an Eishidish is something that even Torah, or even being Moshe Rabbeinu, can't protect you from, and that you still end up in Dina Shel Geinom. Over here, the Gemara seems to have a slightly different view, that Torah can protect the individual in these cases, and that's how it protected David HaMelech. There has to be a reconciliation between them. You could argue that they're both true, that you will get punished, but it doesn't mean that God will completely leave the individual. Although again, from the Gemara and Dalet Amud Bet, it seemed that it was much more severe than simply the distinction that you would draw in that way. So now, my boz yavuzulo. So this is actually a continuation of the pasuk. The Gemara continues here to darshan the psukim and says, boz yavuzulo, which is, maim rabim lo yuchlu lo chabote da'ava, great waters can't wash away that love, the limud Torah. Boz yavuzulo, many people will expend money, which is, money can't buy me love. Right, so it was not originated by some singers in the 20th century, but rather it came out of Shir HaShirim, which is you can spend as much money as you'd like, but you can't buy love. So Amarullah, what does that mean? Lo kishimon achi azariah, v'lo k'rab yochanan d'benisiya, ela k'hilel v'shavna. D'chiyata Ravdimi, when Ravdimi came, Amar, Hillel v'shavna achai avu. Hillel v'shavna were brothers. Hillel asak b'torah. Hillel engaged in Torah, and we know the stories of Hillel and the tremendous poverty that he endured and what he went through to learn Torah. Shavna, his brother, Avadiska, went out and opened up a business, was very successful. So for Malay, Tana Rovaliflog, he came back after, he says, let's do a deal. I'll give you some money, you give me some Torah, everything will be great. Yatz Tabatko Vamra, but the heavenly voice came out and says, Imiten Ish et Kolhon Beito, which is the final part of that pasuk. If a person gives up all their wealth, they still can't buy Ahava. But over here we mean the Ahava is Torah. So what it means is no matter how much one expends and how much one wants to buy that Torah, that is not a way, you cannot do that. Now the Gemara here contrasts partnerships that are okay versus partnerships that didn't work. Partnerships of Shimon Achi Azariah, as well as Rabbi Yochanan de Benisiyah, which is interesting. Shimon, who was the brother of Azariah, so Shimon was a Talmud Chacham, the brother of Azariah. And throughout Shas, his name is Shimon Achi Azariah. Why? Because Azariah went out to do business and supported his brother Shimon. And through the support of his brother, he was able to learn Torah. Therefore, his Torah is known by his brother's name because his brother facilitated it, was the one who paid. This goes back to that idea that you in Torah, you can facilitate and get full credit. And the same thing by Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan, who was supported by the house of the Nasi, also, the house of Nasi is giving credit for Rabbi Yochanan's Torah. What's the difference between that and Hillel and Shavna? It's a question of whether it was done post facto or it was preemptively done. In the case of Shimon and Achai Azariah, Shimon and Azariah made a hesken. They had a deal between them that Azariah would go out and work and support Shimon so that he could learn Torah. So since the deal was put in place up front, that is where it works, that the person who's supporting the one who's learning Torah gets the benefit or the credit of the Limud Torah. The same thing with Rabbi Yochanan and the Beit Nasi. The problem with Hillel and Shavna was that Shavna came after the fact. Hillel endured tremendous poverty in order to learn, and now all of a sudden, after the fact, Shabbat wants to come along and say, I'm going to buy into your Torah. That doesn't work. Here, it's clear that you have to have the arrangement up front where that money will be used towards the facilitation of someone learning Torah or engaging in Torah, and then you get the credit as if you learned the Torah, or that person, actually, their Torah is al shimcha, is on the name of the individual who supported the Torah. But if you go after the fact and you want to buy in to get the credit of the Limud Torah, that doesn't work because of the pasuk over here that you can spend all your money on love. Doesn't matter. You're not going to be successful at that. That's true from both sides of this, which is the arrangement has to be made up front, both from the person who's learning Torah and from the person who is supporting them. That the supporter gets credit because it was the arrangement was made up front. The individuals learning Torah can do this because it's prearranged that they will be supported. What neither can do is the party can't come afterwards and try to buy the Torah, but also the other way around. The person can't learn Torah and then say, you must pay for my learning of Torah. And that has to be prearranged. It can't be that either party then says to the other person, you're obligated to take care of me because I engaged in such a manner. All right, now the Gemara goes back to that which was said in the Mishnah, which needs more explanation, which is the fact that there are different opinions as to what one should do with regards to their daughter. Now we know, Limud HaTorah is protection that is provided to the woman. Should you now teach her that? Omer ben Azai, Chayav Adam Lamed Et Bito Torah. He has to teach her Torah. Why does he have to teach her Torah according to ben Azai? To teach her Torah so that she knows that when the Meisulta don't work, it's because Zchut Tolala. Zchut Tolala, so he has to teach her that in order that she knows it. Rabbi Lezer Omer, Kom Lamed Et Bito Torah, Belamda Tiflut. Anybody teaches Torah to his daughter is teaching her tiflut. The Gemara says, tiflut zakadatcha? Even if you teach her Torah, Torah remains Torah. How can you say that Torah itself is tiflut? That can't be. Ela ema kilu lamda tiflut. It's as if he teaches her tiflut. What tiflut is a machloket rishonim. Rashi over here, you can see Rashi, the way that he translates it over here. So it seems to be Tosfot also translated that way. Is tiflut means znut. He's teaching her znut. As Rashi said on the Mishnah, he's giving her the ability or the capacity, he says it over here as well, to then become smart. She has a deviousness now that she can utilize to execute on her znut and get away with it. Because she understands how it works, then she knows how to beat the system. And so that's what it means, tiflut over here, because you're teaching her the methods by which to get out of the punishment or to execute on her desires and not get into trouble for it. On the other hand, the Rambam writes in the Perusha Mishnayot, it's a very interesting saying. He says, tiflut is, v'amru melamda tiflut hi divrei havai v'divrei mashalim. It's just teaching her meaningless and worthlessness or like fables. And he codifies it that way in Mishnah Torah as well. Now it'll turn out that the Rambam seemingly has a much stronger view here about why you shouldn't teach the Torah. Rashi and Tosafot indicate that the problem is because she will have understanding. And because of that understanding, then she'll become wise. That wisdom will give her the ability then to perform znut and get away with it. Then the Rambam says that teaching them Torah is a meaningless engagement. It's not worthwhile. And the reason he says is because the women don't have the capacity to learn and understand the Torah. That's the way the Rambam formulates it in Mishnah Torah. So seemingly the Rambam has a much stronger formulation against teaching the women Torah, but it'll turn out in the end that the Rambam's formulation is what gives the petach, the opening, to allow women to learn because of his formulation. So it's ironic that the Rambam's formulation here, which seems to be much stronger and in a way much more denigrating towards women, in the end becomes the platform from which we get to the point where you possibly, that women could learn Torah, or have a question of what happened here versus what happens today. Right, we'll go through that in a minute, but just be aware of that fact as it's majorly impacted how you read the word tiflut. So I'm Rabbi Bo, my time with Rabbi Eliezer. What's the reason behind Rabbi Eliezer's position? Dichtiv. Ani chuchma, shachanti orma. That I, the wisdom, I live or dwell amongst the cunning. Kevin shenichnesa chuchma ba'adam. When a person becomes wise, nichnesa imo armumit. Then also cunningness enters into him. In that the chuchmah, or the Gemara cup, is not simply a acquirement or attainment of Torah. It's a method of thinking. It's a intellectual engagement that teaches a person then to figure things out. That's why many people say that if you learn Gemara, then you become a great lawyer, because you're engaging the same skill set that you use by Gemara in lawyering, and trying to figure out, oh, it could be this way, it could be that way. So it's that type of cunningness, or a strength of wisdom, also brings with it negative aspects, not always that are positive aspects. Rabbanon, the Rabbanon who disagree with Rabbi Eliezer, Hay ani chokhmah may of delay. What do they do with that? Mi bayalei kedar Rabbi Yosi b'Rabbi Chanina. They need it for Rabbi Yosi b'Chanina. Damar Rabbi Yosi b'Chanina ain divrei Torah mitkamim el b'misha ma'amid atzmo arum aleihem. The Torah only stays with someone who makes themselves naked over them. Shneim ani chokhmah shechanti orma. Rashi over here says, what does it mean that he makes himself naked over them? Is that perush sheperish mikol atzakim, that he leaves all other business engagements? Nasel ani v'chaser kol. He makes himself impoverished and with nothing. That's how he can acquire Torah. Lishnachrina, he brings the second Lashon, which probably be more appealing to most of the people here. Shemisim as marum alea garsinen shmarim sheit kayim torato. That he does these tricks, and he's cunning about how to remember the Torah. He makes simanim, he tries all these different pretense in order to remember the Torah, or to be engaged in Torah. Like botza yad lamud mikol adam. In order to hear shiurim and to learn Torah and to remember Torah. So ma'arim over here either can mean that, again, that stripped of anything, which means that a person has to give up any other engagement in order for Torah to really be with them and for them to be true. Tamidei chachamim, that's one interpretation. Rashi says arum. The other interpretation is that that cunningness has to be used to engage one's ability then to remember Torah. That you have to come up with these tricks and ways to remember Torah, to acquire Torah. The Torah only is acquired by someone who makes themselves as if they're not. So now, where can you find it from? That's the way. But here he says, me'ayin means from nothingness, timza. That when you have nothingness, that's where chukmah, that's where Torah is found. And that's what it says, minasui ka'ayin. From someone who makes themselves like a nothing, that's where Torah is found. Now, Tosfot here makes a comment which is interesting. Tosfot says about Ben Azai's comment that a chayav adam to teach his daughter Torah. Why does he have to teach his daughter Torah? Not for the knowledge of Torah itself, but that so she knows when the meisotah don't affect her, that's because she has the zchut of Torah. So she has to learn that. Tosfot over here says, Yushalmi, the Ben Azai deloka Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Ben Azai is not equivalent to the shita of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. What is Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's shita? That is from the Gemara in Chagiga, talking about Hakel. By Hakel, it says there that Anashim, Nashim, V'taf. That when you come up to Yerushalayim for Hakel, you have the men, the women, the children all come there. Why do the men, women, and children come there? So he says, Anashim Baim L'Umot. The men come to learn. Nashim Lishmoa. The women come to hear the Torah. And then the Taf is they Havi Ischut the Mevi'ehen. To give credit to those that bring them. That they get credit for bringing the kids there. V'nira, the parish mitzvah lishmo anashim kdei sheyedu lekayem mitzvah. B'lo sheyedu sheshchut tolah. So he says that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's view of what the women need to know is that they have to learn Torah so they know what to do. They know what mitzvah they have to mekayem. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's understanding of what women learn is right. It's not a view that they know it so that they know that that's why the meisotah doesn't work. But rather, it's for knowledge, so they understand what they need to do and what mitzvot they need to accomplish. The Yushalmi contrasts Ben Azai with Rabbi Elazar ben Azai, is saying that Ben Azai and Rabbi Elazar ben Azai are not the same opinion. The Ben Azai doesn't look at Limud Torah in that way. He simply says she needs to know. That's why the Meisotah don't work. That's it. But Rabbi Elazar ben Azai has a more expansive view, which is Lishmoa, that they have to hear, they have to learn the Torah. They need knowledge of Torah. The Rambam paskins like Rabbi Eliezer over here, and almost all the poskim paskin like Rabbi Eliezer over here, which is that kol amaleid bito Torah b'lam datzi flut. That's the way the Rambam paskins. In addition, the Rambam adds something over there, which is not clear where the Rambam got it from. Rav Kapach claims that the Rambam had a different girsa in the Gemara, or he had to have some different source because we don't have a source that says what the Rambam says. The Rambam says that mamed very mamurim b'torah shebal peh. That's only true by Torah Shebal Peh. By Torah Shebichtav, that's not true. So Rambam over there makes a distinction between Torah Shebichtav versus Torah Shebal Peh, where the teaching of Torah Shebichtav is not considered to be tiflut, even though a father shouldn't necessarily teach his daughter Torah Shebichtav, But if he does teach her Torah Shebichtav, it's not deemed to be Tiflut. Then when it's Torah Shebaal Peh, then that's considered to be Tiflut. So that's a very big distinction that the Rambam makes, which is brought to Halacha. The question is, where did the Rambam get it from? Many of the Achronim, or the commentaries on the Rambam, try to figure out where the source for the Rambam is. Some ignore it and don't even ask where he got it from. The Taz has a suggestion that it comes from Elazar ben Azariah. It comes from Elazar ben Azariah, who says that by Hakel, the women came up Lishmoa, to learn Torah. Hakel revolves around Limuda Torah, that is Torah Shebichtav. There they read from Sefer Dvarim and Hakel. That's Torah Shebichtav. Our Gemara here is talking about Torah Shebaal Peh. How do I know it's talking about Torah Shebaal Peh? Because what does Ben Azai say you have to teach the woman? You have to teach her that Zchut is Torah. That if she has a Zchut, the Mesutah won't work. That's not found in the Torah. That's Torah Shebaal Peh. On that, Rabbi Eliezer says, Kol Melamed Bito Torah Kilum Lamda Tiflut. So that's what the Taz says is the source for the Rambam. The fact is that our Gemara here seems to be talking about Torah Shebaal Peh. And that's where Rabbi Eliezer's comment is made. On the other hand, Torah Shebichtav, which is a product of Hakel, that we know is something that the woman is engaged in. That's what Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says. Based on that, maybe that's how the Rambam came up with the distinction between Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. The other distinction that is brought, and this basically begins to open up the different doors that allow a woman to learn. Here we have one door that's opened by the Rambam already, which is Torah Shebichtav, which is Torah Shebaal Peh. The Sefer Chassidim, again, who's not known for his liberal views, says that when it comes to Limud HaTorah, that women have to learn Torah in order to understand the mitzvot that they are going to do. That knowing how to do a mitzvah properly not only involves knowing how to do the mitzvah, but also involves learning in order to be able to do the mitzvah. So here you have, again, the first time you have an expansion of the view of which Limud HaTorah the woman is exempted from or should not be engaged in. Over there, Sefer Chassidim seems to indicate that a woman should be engaged in Torah in order to know how to perform the mitzvot. And therefore, it's a prerequisite, or it's a part and parcel of doing the mitzvot. And therefore, a woman can be engaged in learning in order to do or be involved with the mitzvot. That's the first petach that opens up. The next big petach that opens up is over time. You see this through different tshuvot that come about. I would just note that if you go to the Chovos Yair, his introduction to his tshuvot in the Chovos Yair, as well as the Prisha in his introduction in Yoredeya, to his commentary in Yoredeya, both of them speak about women being huge role models for them and their inspiration. The Prisha writes about his mother. He's writing the Chidushim, I think, that really associate with his father. The son is writing them, and he writes about his mother, that she was a huge Talmidah Chachama. She's sitting at their table, and she used to engage in the halachic discourse at the table with the Talmidim. And over there, he quotes some things from his mother, which he thinks his mother said about candle lighting, certain issues with regards to Shechiyanu, and with regards to lighting candles on Yom Tov, that she had certain views over here, which he thinks are right, and he brings them down. The Magen Avraham argues on that and says that his mother should have been sewing and not learning Torah because she's wrong. But anyway, many come to the defense. Rabbi Akiva Eiger and others come to the defense of the mother of the Prisha. And there you see, again, a woman who was erudite and well-versed in Torah. The Chovos Yair speaks again about his mother, again, being a mother or grandmother, being a huge inspiration to him. His book is named after her. The Chovos Yair names his book or his tshuvot after her, that she was a huge inspiration. And again, he says over there that she was engaged in the halachic discourse. And at times, I think after the passing of her husband, that she was actually in the Beit Midrash, and they used to ask her shilas based on what had happened earlier on, or based on her husband. So again, we know that there were yechidei skula along the time, that women who did learn, and learned not just learned, but learned full scale. That leads to some of the tshuvah that we see along the way, which is that one may not teach the women Torah Shebaal Peh, but if they learn it on their own, or if they're engaged in it, then one can engage. And that really comes out of this Rambam. The Rambam over here says the reason we don't teach the women Torah is because they don't understand it. It's not something that is meaningful to them. They make it into a meaningless or worthless pursuit when they learn Torah. So that would indicate that now you have a het there, which is that if it's not treated that way, if they engage in Torah in a manner that doesn't make it worthless or derech mashalim, then they would be allowed to engage in Torah. So there you see some of those tshuvot in the 18th and 19th century that start to engage or mention these women or yechidei skula, that it might be okay. The big turning point obviously happens with the advent of the Beis Yaakov movement. Because the Beis Yaakov movement changes the whole dynamic of women's education, which is eventually given the stamp of approval by the Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaim writes in his Likutei Halachot, his Sota, here he writes in his Likutei Halachot, supporting the fact that we need to educate girls now in Torah. And that what worked in the past, which is the idea of Mesorah, Shalavicha v'yageitcha, Zekeinecha v'yomrulach, that there is a certain amount of Mesorah that is passed down in the household, and that a girl who grows up in a household will be imbued with the knowledge of how to do mitzvot, and the ability to have Yirat Shemayim, Yirat Chet, and Torah was a product of the household. The women were able to do that because, first of all, the women grew up in a household. The household had that aura about it, and the women were engaged in it and passed down from generation to generation. But he says in the modern times now, where many times the younger girls are leaving the house, number one. Number two is they're being educated in, sometimes and many times in secular institutions, and getting education that many times that this Mesorah is failing. It's not passing from the mother to daughter, that we have to create a more formalized way of engaging these women and these girls in Torah. This is prior to the Beis Yaakov movement. The Chofetz Chaim writes it a more general statement. After Sarah Schneer opens up the Beis Yaakov, where she gets the approbation of the Belzer Rebbe, she was a Belzer Chassid, and through her brother, she gets the approbation of the Belzer Rebbe, even though she never told him that she was opening up schools. She just said she wanted to teach women Torah, or get them to be engaged more in Torah. She never said she could open up a school system, but the school system got a tremendous amount of traction once she opened it up. And the original school system was to teach women to be teachers of other women. That's what it was for. It wasn't for students. It became so popular that within a very short time, by 1938, pre-war, pre-Holocaust, there were 35,000 girls enrolled in Beis Yaakov. Now, the Beis Yaakov is a product of Polish Jewry, a Hasidic Jewry. Already in Germany, there was already more formalized education for girls in a much earlier period, probably because of Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, who writes, he has a commentary in his Siddur, a similar idea to the Likutei Halachot of the Chofetz Chaim, which is that we need to engage girls in Torah today. Because the only way that we're going to keep girls to be Yirei Shemayim and Yirei Chet is if they have a connection to the Torah. And the connection of the Torah doesn't happen unless you learn Torah. And one must learn Torah and engage in Torah in order to then have that connection to Torah and have that permanent guide in life is only if they have that. It's not working through a Mesorah. It's not working through the households. These women are exposed to so much. And that the Chofetz Chaim writes, finally when he gives his letters of Haskamot to the Beis Yaakov as they opened up, he writes clearly in his letters there that these girls are going out and being educated and they're going to gymnasiums and they're learning and higher levels of education in the secular realm, and it's a fait accompli. He doesn't discuss whether that's right or not, but that's where they are now. If they're going to be there, we need to educate them. We need to counter that with an education inside of the Torah world. And that's what, again, starts this process of a formalization of education for the girls. What should be the curriculum or content of that? That still remains questionable. That's not addressed by the Chofetz Chaim. And even Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, who seems to give a much broader scope. And again, it's in his commentary to the Siddur, on I think page 122 in his commentary to the Siddur there, where he says that he gives a much broader scope, or seems to open up the door to allow education of women on a much broader level than simply Torah Shebichtav. But there, it's not specific. The first time we get more specific is a Chakira that is set out by the Beis Halevi. In his Tshuvot, the Beis Halevi says that when it comes to Limud HaTorah, there's a chakira, there's trei dinim in Limud HaTorah. There's Limud HaTorah for the sake of Limud HaTorah, something that was, again, very popularized by Rav Chaim Volozhin and the Nefesh HaChaim, this idea of Limud Torah Lishma, to simply learning Torah. But there's also Limud HaTorah, which is a Limud HaTorah which gives the ability or facilitates the ability to do mitzvot and engage in what we're supposed to do, to give us Lishmor V'Lasot. That you need to do, you engage in Torah. That's also Limud HaTorah. And the Beis Halevi there in that Chakira says that women are Chayavot in Torah. That involves the engagement of mitzvot and Lishmar Lasot. They may not be Chayavot in the mitzvah of Torah Lishma. And therefore, the Birkat HaTorah that the women make, why do women make Birkat HaTorah? They make Birkat HaTorah because they're Chayavot in Limud HaTorah. What Limud HaTorah? Limud HaTorah that is an extension of the mitzvah. The Beis Halevi basically expands on what the Sefer Hasidim said. Sefer Hasidim has said before that women have to learn Torah to know what to do, the mitzvot. The Beis Halevi expands that and says that any Limud HaTorah that gets one the ability or facilitates the ability to do a mitzvah, that Limud HaTorah is considered to be an extension of the mitzvah and is subsumed under the din of the mitzvah. And therefore, women are chayavot in that type of limud Torah because they're chayavot in those mitzvot. Beis Halevi goes on to also discuss that with regards to a Yisrael learning mitzvot that involve kohanim. Like, what? How does that work? We're learning Torah about the way to do a mitzvah for a kohen when Yisrael engages in that Torah. What type of limud Torah is that? Okay, so he deals with it in a more broader perspective, but he tells that about women. And that really, again, expands this view of what women can learn. Because it's not only Torah Shebichtav, it's Torah Shebichtav and also Torah Shebalpeh or Lachot that give them the ability then to do the mitzvot, Lishmor Velatzot. They have to have that ability, and therefore it expands, again, the purview of items that a woman may engage in. In the modern era, then we have a tshuva from Rav Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein. It's a very short tshuva from Moshe Feinstein. It's a question from Elliot Zvei from the yeshiva in Philadelphia asking whether girls should learn Mishnayot. And so Rav Moshe Feinstein answers back. He says, no question they should not learn Mishnayot, but they should be learning Pirkei Avot. So even though it's a Mishnah, and even though it's Torah Shebalpeh, they should learn Pirkei Avot because that has in it the fundamentals of Musar, the fundamentals of Torah perspective. And women need that. And it's a fundamental part of their education, their Yirat Chet, they should be engaged in it. So again, he's walking a fine line saying that Torah Shebalpeh by Avot is okay, by other Mishnayot is not okay. But that's clearly the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, again, expanding the horizons or the areas where we allow women to engage. Again, in the modern era with Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who expanded on the Beit HaLevi, they basically accept the Beit HaLevi and then expand it even further to say that a woman's engagement in Torah Shebaal Peh can only be made permanent, and can only be made something that stays with them and they're willing to work through it as if they have large exposure to it. Torah Shebaal Peh and engaging in Gemara is a very difficult activity. It brings no pleasure when you first start out. It's a very difficult for one to overcome. It takes years of plumbing in Gemara in order to get to a point where one has a familiarity with the Gemara and he has the ability then to learn Gemara in a way that provides them the perspective to then look at other things. And they say that that's also part of the learning here, which is that the woman's engagement in that Torah Shebaal Peh is important because otherwise she will never go and learn the Torah Shebaal Peh. It's even shayach to the mitzvot or the items that are relevant to her. And therefore, it requires a larger engagement in Torah Shebaal Peh. That's one thing they say. And then they also engage the Chafetz Chaim's principle, which is that we see many women today getting involved in higher professions. They get involved and they're educated in higher educations in the case where they're getting master's degrees, where they're getting doctorates, and they're doing all these other things. The same problem that was faced by the Chafetz Chaim in the girls being educated in secular schools. If they can attain such heights in the secular world, how can we then say to them in the Torah world that they cannot attain those heights? Those avenues should not be open to them. What you're going to do then is, these women are going to then leave the world of Torah, because the world of Torah doesn't provide them the same challenges and opportunities that the secular world does. And now, that's true, definitely in the world that opens up secular studies to women, but even in the more Haredi world where women now do go out into the workforce, especially in America versus Israel, but in America where they're going out to the workforce, and they're getting educated, and they're educated in areas that are of significantly higher levels, and that not to allow them to engage in Torah at the same level, then skews their view about secular versus Torah, and therefore it's important to engage them in Torah. And for those reasons, Von Lichtenstein was a huge promoter of women's learning, especially higher women's learning, because of the need to balance that. Now again, that has to be offset, I think, very importantly, to not be mixed up, and then Rav Soloveitchik was very adamant about this, with feministic tendencies or feminist movements, which are not after the Limud Torah itself, but are after equality. It's not an issue of equality, it's not an issue of these feminists that want to change it and say that it's a male-dominated religion and that we have to change the halacha. Those should not be the impetuses for this learning. The learning has to be learning in the Shema. People want to engage in Torah. They want to learn Torah because they want to gain more. They want to have Yirat Chet. They want to have Yirat Shemayim. They want Torah to be the perspective on life. And that attitude becomes a huge part of this, and it's important. It's very hard to deal with in these situations because once you engage in Torah on these levels, it's hard to be discerning or to separate out these issues. And therefore, unfortunately, there is a high correlation between women's higher learning and many times a lower standard of adherence to halacha that comes with that. Part of that is because of the fact that the women who are more liberalized or secularized are the ones who feel that they can engage in Torah and they're less bound by the Mesorah in that way. But it also comes with the woman feeling that when she's educated, she can make her own decisions and she doesn't have to be. It's an unfortunate correlation between them because had it been that the correlation stayed much stronger, that women who were in higher learning and engaged in higher learning stayed as frommer than their counterparts, then that would be a huge impetus to draw more women into learning because it would say that it furthers their Yirat Chet and Yirat Shemayim rather than degrades it. And therefore, it has to be a careful balance here. Many times I say that you have to differentiate between the institutionalization of these items versus the teaching of individuals. Whether that Torah Shebaal Peh or Gemara should be institutionalized to the point where girls should always engage in it, even in high school, whether they're interested or not, that might be the difference. Maybe it's not worthwhile to do it in that way because that is something that leads to this other view or leads to the view of the Rambam. Then if there are women who are driven and women who want to engage in it, then we have to provide them the frameworks and the institutions by which they can learn it if they want to learn it. And so that's an important distinction that has to be made or maybe has to be looked at as to whether it should be institutionalized like we do for boys where everybody learns Gemara. Even for boys, doesn't work for everybody. But over there, at least they have an active mitzvah of mitzvah voseh versus for girls where that isn't the case. And therefore, maybe we should take a slightly different view over there. Again, not to withhold it from them, not to stop them from learning, but have them engage more actively in it in order for them to be educated in that way rather than simply making that the default method of education. All right, I'll try to send out the mikorot so that you can look at them, but it's an interesting development from what the Gemara says over here to what we have in the modern day. Again, through the prism of many different societies and halachists, as well as different genres. Saying it's not only a product of the Haskalah or the more secularized Judaism, it's even a product or a realization within the more Haredi world that there's a need to engage the women in Torah in order to preserve what we have or the Mesorah that we have. Now the Gemara says, Rabbi Yeshua Omer, the Mishnah then went off into a sidebar and says that Rotsa Isha, that a woman would rather have kav v'tiflut, that a woman would rather have a kav and tiflut, rather than tisha kavin, nine kav and frishut. So Mar says, my kamar, what is the meaning of this? Hochi gamar, utza isha b'kav v'tiflut imo, v'tisha kavin v'frishut. The way that the Rabbeinu Chananel brings this down, the way Rashi explains it over here, that a woman would rather have less wealth, less success of her husband's material success, and have her husband around all the time, versus a case where her husband will be very successful in business, bring her more material success, but not be around. And so the example that they bring is a chamar, a donkey driver, which is basically is a short haul mover, who's always home every week he comes home. So therefore she gets her own na. She gets to engage with her husband on a weekly basis. But he makes a living that is must speak, but not huge. The other hand, he could be a gamal, which is a long-haul mover, a long-haul driver, but he's gone for 30 days at a time, and he comes back. So she only gets her husband every 30 days. So he'll be much more successful. He'll bring back 9 kav, and they'll be much wealthier, but she'd rather have her husband than have the more wealth and not have her husband around. So that's what Rabbi Yeshua is stating. The Tosafot over here brings from Rabbi Perish, B'shem Rav Hai, Avigon explains it based on a Gemara that we saw in Ketubot, that a woman who refuses to engage in marital relations with her husband is penalized. There's a certain fine or knas that's imposed on her. The value of that knas turns out to be 9 times as much as what a woman gets when she remains with her husband. A woman who is behaving properly and engaging with her husband gets a certain allowance each week. If she refuses to engage with her husband, then there's a financial penalty that we impose on her until she runs down her ketubah, in order to try to convince her to engage in marital relations. That penalty, if you add it up, is 9 times as much as what she gets on a regular basis. And that's what Rav Hai suggests is meant by Rabbi Yeshua's statement over here, that a woman who acts in the proper manner would rather take her small allowance and be together with her husband and be happy, rather than to refuse to be with her husband in order and then get this huge penalty that comes along. But he sees that as being the comparison here of 9 to 1. The way that the Rambam formulates it is, Yoter me'adam chassid parush min ha'beirot. She'd rather have Isha rotza be'ish zanai manshei ha'sheker. That she would want a dishonest person, a man, but a man who engages with her and maybe is in a little more promiscuous and only get a kav b'chol yom le'mizanotah and only get a small amount for her livelihood. Yoter me'adam chassid parush min ha'beirot. More than someone who is a Yirei Hashem, Yirat Chait, and is an honest individual, even though he brings her a better living, she would be more interested in the man who is more promiscuous and engages with her more. This Chassid Shoteh, these are people who destroy the world, all these different individuals. Heichi Dami Chassid Shoteh, what is the case of a Chassid Shoteh? Fortunately, this is a prevalent phenomenon today. Something that needs to be dealt with is kagon. Katova itata minara. There's a woman drowning in the river. I can't look at women. I can't touch women. I can't save her. So it's a matter of life and death. The woman's going to drown. In the meantime, the guy says, I'm too from to deal with a woman in the water. And then he lets her drown instead of saving her. So that's a case of a chassid shoteh. It also gives another example of a chassid shoteh. The Yerushalmi brings that he sees a baby bobbing in the water, drowning in the water, and he's wearing his tefillin. He says, you know what? When I take my tefillin off, then I'll go in and jump in and get him. So by the time he takes his tefillin off, the baby's long gone and drowned. And that person is so from that he can't engage in hatzalat nefashot, what's called basic decency and morality, because he thinks he's too from to do it. That's called a chassid shoteh. The Rambam in the Peshet Mishnayot gives an interesting summary of what he thinks the Gemara says here about a chassid shoteh. He says that a chassid shoteh is someone who engages in activities that they're not chayav in, that they do chumrot upon chumrot, and that's what makes them a chassid shoteh, because as the Gemara says in other places, mishu patur midavar voseo nikra hejot. The Rishalmi says that an individual engages in activities that he's not chayav in is like a hejot. He's a lay person. That's silly to engage in things that you're not obligated to engage in. And that is a chassid shoteh. As the Rambam says, it's the ilu shoteh. V'yaseh masim she'ena mechuyavim kilu shoteh b'chassiduto. He does things that he's not obligated in, as if he is crazy about his chassidut, about his righteousness or zealousness, and therefore he engages in all these activities that make him seem to be more religious or engaged than he really is. And that is this chassid shoteh. Rasha rum, hechidami rasha rum. What's the case of a Rasha Rum? Am Rabbi Yochanan zeh matim dvarav dayan kodem shevo baldin chabero. This is a person who makes his case before the dayan, before his friend is present. Which is in the modern law is ex parte, that you're not allowed to present your side of the case before the other individual is there so that he can counter, that he can present his case. That's obvious because once you presented your case, you've already drawn the judge over to your side. And then when he hears everything else afterwards, he's skeptical because he already has a certain perspective on the case based on what you told him. And that's a Rosh Harum, is someone who is cunning and does what's wrong now because he biases the judge in doing this. Rabbi Bo Omar, Zeh noten diyan nar l'ani l'ashlim lo 200 zuz. What's a Rosh Harum? It's a guy who gives an ani one zuz, and that one zuz gets it to 200 zuz. And that's because there's a rule by Meister Ani, that's not, mi sheyesh lo 200 zuz, lo yitol leket shechal peya. By Meiser Ani, by Leket Shechal Peya, if you have 200 zuz, you're over the threshold by which you're allowed now to collect Leket Shechal Peya, as well as Meiser Ani. Hayalo matayim chaser dinar. If he has 200 minus 1 dinar, afilu elef no dimlo, kachat. Harizei yitol. If they give him 1,000 now, he doesn't have to say, oh, one gets me over 200. No. Once you're below 200, you can take as much as you want, but a 200 or above, you can't. So this guy is 199, and you give him a little stukka, now you bring him over 200. That's the worst thing you can do for this guy. Now, he's precluded from collecting Leket Shecha Peyan and Meser Ani, because you gave him one zuz. Had you not given him the zuz, he could have collected, and could have collected much more. So that's what the Mishnah says. The Mishnah says that if he goes and collects, or he gets a Meser Ani of 1,000 zuz in one shot, he doesn't have to say, the first zuz gets me over 200, I don't take the rest. No. As long as you're below 200, you can take it in as much as you want at that point in time. Once you cross the 200 threshold, then you have to stop taking. How you cross the 200 threshold doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it takes one zuz to cross or you get 1,000 zuz. Whatever you get at that time that brings you across the 200 threshold, you can keep. If he gets 100 or 1,000, when he crosses over the 200, he's off the dole. Over here, he's going to cross the threshold. The question is how he crosses the threshold. If you cause him to cross the threshold with this tiny amount, you're doing him a disservice. Because if he crossed over the threshold with a much bigger amount, yes, he would have been disqualified, but at least he would have gotten a big gift that gets him across that threshold. By you giving that small amount and bringing him across the threshold, you're really hurting him. And that's why he's called the Rasha Arum. And maybe even the Ani himself could deny it, say, I don't want to take it here because he's going to push me across the threshold, and then I won't be able to take a bigger gift that comes along. And that bigger gift that comes along, it also take me across the threshold. I won't be able to collect anymore. But I'd rather go across the threshold collecting 100 or 1,000 than collecting one to go across the threshold. This is the one who gives advice to Yitomim to sell the property when there are limited assets in the estate. The rule is, when there are assets in the estate, technically the boys are the only inheritors of their father. So when there are a large number of assets in the estate, the boys inherit it, and then they take care of the girls. The girls get mizonot out of the estate. In the case where the nechasim mulatim, there isn't a large amount of property in the estate, then the boys get no Yerusha, and then the girls get mizonot out of the estate. In that case, nechasim mulatim, it works because the property that's there is encumbered to the mizonot that the father basically commits to the daughters. Now then, if the boys liquidate the estate and sell it, it becomes metaltalim. And metaltalim are not mishabdeh to the mizonot of the women. So if they jump the gun and sell the property, we can't stop them because technically min haTorah it's their property. And if they do sell it, then the girls are knocked out and they get nothing. So it's someone who advises the Yitomim to do this, by nechasim mulatim, to sell it, to basically disinherit the girls, then that is Rasha Arum. If Yitomim jump the gun and then engage in transactions with the estate, when the estate is a small asset, what they sold, and then the girls are out and they can't collect mizonot. It might be different for the widow, the almana, who has a claim against the, not just the estate after the death of the father, but has a claim against the father during his lifetime. Her claim might supersede over here. That's what Tosafot talks about, that the almana will have a right to block the sale because she has a first right of refusal because she has an encumbrance that is pre-exists the death of the father. The girl's ability to collect mizonot only comes into effect once the father passes away. So at the passing of the father, that's when they first get their encumbrance. At that point, the boys also gain their yerusha, so they don't trump the boy's ability to sell the property. On the other hand, the almana, who has an encumbrance that pre-exists the death of the father, that might supersede their ability to sell her, and she could block the sale or demand that she gets paid out her mizonot. This is someone who gives advice to sell property like Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. The Tanya, we had this in Ketubot. My possessions go to you. And after you to someone else. It's a remainder trust. Eventually, it gives it to one person and says, whatever is left over goes to the next party afterwards. The first one goes and sells the property, eats from the property. Rabbi says the second individual has a lien on the property. That is, once the first guy's gone, he can then go get the property away from the buyers, from whoever has it, because he has a lien on the property. It's a remainder trust. The way it was set up is, if there's what's to be left over, then number two gets it. If number one leaves nothing over, then number two has nothing to get. That means if number one sells the property, number two gets nothing. So that's what Abaye says over here. Someone who advises someone in a remainder trust, the first guy to sell the property, to basically disinherit the second inheritor here, then that is a Rasha Arum. Because it's clear that the person who gifted it wanted some of it to remain to the second individual. By giving advice to this individual, which will work if he sells the property or he uses it all up, there'd be nothing left for this individual, it works. And that's the way that a remainder trust functions, according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Nevertheless, this was never the intent of the gifter that you do that. And by advising the person in the first role of inheritance to do that, you're a Rasha Arum, because you're basically benefiting him at the expense of the other party. And as Tosfot says over here, he's called a Rasha Arum, because over here he's giving advice that does not benefit him. It benefits the first party. So he's giving advice that does something to disinherit the second inheritor of the remainder trust, that it will benefit the first party, but he gets no benefit. So here you're giving advice to cheat another person out, not cheat, to disinherit another party, even though there's no personal benefit to you. And since there's no personal benefit over here, you're called a Rasha Arum. Over here, the guy basically says, look, you used the property, eat from it all that time, and after you die, the other guy will get the property. But over here, what he does is sells the property in the meantime. So not only does he take all the benefit from the payroll to the property, he also now sells the Karen, the principal out. By selling out the principal, there's nothing left for this individual. And that is a Rosh Arum. Again, and same thing by the case of the Yitomim. Here, giving advice to people to get benefit from acting this way when you have no personal benefit from it. You're getting nothing out of it. And that's what Tosfot says over here. There are other cases which may not be so nice to do it. But if you do it, you're not called the Rosh Arum because you get personal benefit from it. If you're doing it because you are the beneficiary of it, then it may not be the nicest thing to do. It may not be the right thing to do. You're still not called the Rosh Arum in that case because you are a beneficiary of your actions. But that's the way that the Rashbam explains it, that you're not abiding by the original intent of the gifter over here. The phrase given the Masi Nikra Rasha Mechlau Dula Mocher Asur Lasot Lechatchila Afgav Dula Nikra Rasha. He says that even though the party, the first inheritor in the remainder trust, could do this, he's not called a Rasha Arum, but the fact that someone advises him to do it is called a Rasha Arum, tells you lechatchila that he shouldn't do it. Someone advises him to do it is called a Rasha Arum, because Huchotev Lolo, he's sinning here, he's doing something bad and not getting any benefit from it. Miwa Mucher Atzmo, Tan Rishon, Lo Mikre Rasha, Afagav Lechatchila Asur Lasot Kach. It's not called a Rasha, even though lechatchila he shouldn't do this. Because that's what he was granted. He was granted the right to do as he pleases based on the gifter. And therefore he's not called the Rasha over here. Rav Yosef bar Chama, Rav Yosef Shet, what's a Rasha Arum? Zeh machriya acherim b'or chutav. That is someone who tells people to do like me. Follow after me, as Rashi says over here. Lo nitkaven zelo laharot etzmo ki chassid b'nei abriyot. He wants to act in a way that makes him look like he's from a yid, that he is a person who is steeped in Yirat Techet and Yirat Shemayim. He says, do like me. Follow after me. Vein tochol ki baro. But that's not what he feels on the inside. Elo shelo yidaktuhu acharav livdok v'tov v'tav. Basically wants to throw people off. And so he dresses in a certain way. He acts in a certain way in order to make people think he's from. And so that he can use that cover then to go do bad things or to do the wrong things because people won't suspect him because of his outward appearance or the fact that he says, do like me, meaning that he acts in a public way that is quote-unquote from and then goes and engages in all these other activities and is covered by the fact that he looks like a from a yid or he dresses like a from a yid. Rabbi Zvika Maravuna Zem Mikul Atzmo Machmir Le'achirim. Rosh Arum is someone who paskins the cooler for himself and the chumrah for other people. Ulamar ze shikara vishana velo shimesh talmidei chachamim. That's someone who learned mikra, mishnah, was never mishamesh talmidei chachamim. This goes back to that Rashi that we saw yesterday, the difference between Talmud and mishnah, that to learn mikra and mishnah is simply information. That's the mikra, the mishnah, to know what's written in the Torah, the Tanakh, to know what's written in the mishnah. Shimush Talmidei Chachamim is the equivalent of Talmud, which is the ability then to understand how to apply the Mishnayot, how to apply the Halacha, how to answer stirot between the Mishnayot. Basically, the equivalent of Gemara in our time, that's what Shimush Talmidei Chachamim is, the Mod Svarata Gemara, B'tamei Mishnah, Mahim, Rashahu, Shein Tarato Al-Borya, Vein Lumodomenu. This individual is a Rasharum because you can't learn from him. He's going to pass an halacha, he's going to learn things directly from the Mishnah and the Tanakh, and he's not going to get it right, because he doesn't understand how to interpret them, he doesn't understand how or why the reasons behind any of these things, and that is a lack of shimush talmidei chachamim. V'arumu shoshomeit kolo shenei mishnayot kesavur shehu shebaki b'tameihem. He's called a Rasha Arum because he's going to teach people, and they're going to think that he's a baki, and he's an expert in these items, and they're going to learn from him. Nogim bo kavod ketalmidei chachamim. And they're going to honor him like a Talmud Chacham, which is interesting. The Rashi sees that as being the problem. They're going to venerate him like a Talmud Chacham, even though he doesn't have that status of a Talmud Chacham. And that would be problematic, or that'd be improper. It seems to me that the bigger problem is that he's going to teach Torah, but he's not going to teach Torah with the wrong conclusion. And then people's practices then will be thrown off, or they'll get the wrong Mesorah, because he's simply educating them from the knowledge without the Gemara, the explanation that's behind it, or without the ability to be discerning in what he's teaching, because he lacks Shimush Talmidei Chachamim, and that's the bigger problem. But Rashi writes that you have both of these issues. You have the education problem, where he's going to educate others improperly, as well as the fact that the people are going to treat him like a Talmud Chacham. But I guess the two are connected, because if people treat him like a Talmud Chacham, they're going to think he knows, and then they're going to go to him for that information, and he's going to give the wrong information, the wrong Pesach Halacha. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Chav Bet Amud Aleph.